It is Friday, July the 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, a decline in terrorist attacks.
The hope is that the decline will continue, but even if it does, it's still of a modest dimension. We're not looking at a long-term, well, it's too early yet to be talking about long-term declines. It's entirely possible we'll see a fluctuation over the coming years.
Also ahead, President Trump sitting down with the New York Times. O.J. Simpson paroled. We'll have some social media trends, plus something new from Imagine Dragons. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States says the number of terrorist attacks and the deaths that have caused fell in 2016 for the second year in a row as nations cooperate in areas such as information sharing, strengthening security measures, and boosting efforts to counter radicalization and recruitment. According to the University of Maryland's National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, terror attacks fell 9% last year to just over 11,000, while fatalities declined 13% to just over 26,600. This was largely due to a drop in incidents in the countries of Afghanistan, Syria, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Yemen. While attacks occurred in more than 100 countries, they were mostly confined to five nations: Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and the Philippines. 75% of the fatalities occurred in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Nigeria, and Pakistan. The U.S. State Department's acting coordinator for counterterrorism, Justin Cibarel, told reporters in a conference call that the Sunni insurgency Islamic State remained the deadliest jihadist group, while it also lost considerable territory in 2016.
Iraqi security forces, supported by the coalition, delivered a series of defeats on ISIS through 2016, beginning with the liberation of Ramadi in February, the recapture of Fallujah in June, and the seizure of Qayyarah Air Base in northern Iraq in July, and finally the launch of the broad offensive in Nineveh in October that led to Iraqi security force penetration deep into eastern Mosul by the end of the year. In Syria, the border between Syria and Turkey was fully cleared of ISIS presence in 2016. Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by coalition efforts, liberated a number of cities and towns used by ISIS as transit and facilitation hubs for foreign terrorist fighters and ISIS external plotting efforts, including Manbij and Jarablus. These operations set the stage for the operation to isolate and liberate Raqqa, which, as you know, is currently underway.
And the U.S. still considers Iran to be the chief state sponsor of terrorism. Deakin University terrorism expert Greg Barton tells my colleague Victor Beatty parts of the decline in attacks is due to setbacks suffered by Boko Haram in Nigeria, but Barton said IS remains a formidable threat.
Well, it's still the number one threat. Having said that, Al-Qaeda, which is 30 years old now, is stronger today than it's ever been, and various affiliates are more robust and more active than we'd like to imagine. But Islamic State seems set to be a threat for years to come if it manages this transition out of holding territory to being an insurgent force. If there was a breakthrough in politics in Iraq particularly, but also in Syria, we can be optimistic, but I don't think anyone's really expecting the sort of breakthrough that's required to seriously damage this movement from rebuilding itself.
Well, of course, we've had some very high-profile attacks in Europe. More than 100 countries experienced terrorist attacks, but most of them, according to this report, occurred in just five countries: Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and the Philippines.
The addition of India and the Philippines there is a little bit surprising, but of course what we're talking about is more numerous attacks but lower death toll. As a different set of five countries, some overlap, but Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Nigeria last year, as they have been for some years now, accounted for 75% or thereabouts of terrorist deaths. So the more serious attacks are still occurring in those five countries. And it's those five countries that have a chronic breakdown of good governance and are open to a infestation of groups like Boko Haram or Islamic State, and consequently much larger scale attacks and much larger scale death tolls.
Well, Greg, 2 years of declines, what is your sense? Will we see a reversal and perhaps an uptick in 2017?
I don't know about in 2017. The hope is that the decline will continue, but even if it does, it's still of a modest dimension. We're not looking at a long-term, well, at least it's too early yet to be talking about long-term declines. It's entirely possible we'll see a fluctuation over the coming years that move up and down a little bit. A lot will depend upon these five countries where 75% of the terror deaths occur, so Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. We've seen improvement in Nigeria. That's very good. That's where most of the clients have come. We really have to hope for improvements in Iraq and Syria and work towards that. And the long-running problems in Afghanistan connected with issues in Pakistan need to be addressed. Unfortunately, at this stage, Afghanistan's trending in a bad direction, and there's reasons to be concerned about resurgence of problems in Iraq and Syria. So it's much too early to be optimistic, but any decline is a good thing.
Deakin University terrorism expert Greg Barton, he also told VOA's Victor Beatty there has been an uptick in right-wing extremism in North America and Europe, with such attacks rising at the same rate as those carried out by jihadist groups. In a wide-ranging interview with the New York Times newspaper this week, President Trump was asked many questions about the Russia investigation, including a meeting last year with a Russian lawyer in which Mr. Trump's eldest son, Donald Jr., his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his then-campaign advisor, Paul Manafort, took part. They also talked about Attorney General Jeff Sessions recusing himself from any of the Russia probes. My colleague Philip Alexio speaks with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about the ongoing investigations by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller and several congressional committees into alleged collusion between the Trump presidential campaign and Moscow.
Well, it seems as though that the expansion of the investigation now to include the involvement of Trump's son, Donald Jr., in a campaign meeting that included a Russian lawyer, apparently with some dirt to offer on Hillary Clinton, has got the president a little bit concerned. And he seems to be laying out that he thinks Mueller should focus on the Russia probe specifically. But here's the question here. It gets a bit of a gray area, Phil. I mean, if they're looking at a lot of things, it may start to involve whatever economic or financial ties there are with Russia, just as a backdrop. So I think there's been a lot of concern in recent months as to what might prompt the president to want to fire Robert Mueller. He has that right, but there has to be sort of a justification for it under Justice Department rules. In any event, this leaves this whole Russia thing in a bit of a murky quandary right now, but it shows he continues to seethe about the Russia probe. He's very much distracted by it and upset with Jeff Sessions, who, by the way, said today, well, he's planning to continue in his job no matter that article.
Well, now, what prompted that comment by the president? Because Jeff Sessions has been in his corner from the very beginning.
He has, really.
A stalwart supporter of the president. So 6 months down the road to hear him say something like this about Jeff Sessions just seems a little bizarre in that respect.
Sessions was one of the most conservative members of the Senate, and he was the first one to leap onto the Trump campaign. Before any of the rest of them did, he set aside any concerns he had and embraced Trump. They would campaign together. And again, it goes back to this idea that Trump has been bothered from the beginning by the Russia probe. He didn't really appreciate the fact that Sessions early on decided to recuse himself shortly after he became attorney general. And the sense you get from reading this interview is that Trump believes the attorney general should kind of be serving the president in a way and maybe almost acting as a protector. And, you know, traditionally in our country, the attorney general is supposed to be the top law enforcement person in the land and is supposed to try to remove him or herself from politics as much as possible. I think some Republicans, even on Capitol Hill, are a little concerned by these comments regarding Jeff Sessions.
Now, the one last thing I would ask you, when the president is pushing these words, crossing a red line, getting back to Mueller, we don't know what that means, obviously, but that's a pretty powerful thing to say, and you indicated that
obviously they pressed him, mm-hmm. Would you fire him? And he did come back and say, I'm not considering that, or I don't have any plans to do that. But he also said he thinks it would cross a line if the investigation started to move away from specifically dealing with Russia.
That is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, and he was speaking with VOA's Philip Alexio. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Says VOA's International Edition, the head of the French Armed Services has resigned after a clash with President Emmanuel Macron over budget cuts. Henry Ridgewell reporting now for VOA that Macron's new government, trying to balance the books, faces pressure from the cost of military commitments, both at home and overseas.
Following his resignation, General Pierre de Villiers said in a statement that proposed budget cuts this year meant he was unable to guarantee the protection of France. It's the first big test of authority for President Macron, says analyst Sophia Besch of the Centre for European Reform.
But it also shows, and I'm sure that's his intention, that he's serious about making cuts, about bringing the French economy up to speed with the European targets.
Macron wants close to $1 billion shaved from the 2017 defence budget to address the annual deficit. But government spokesman Christophe Castaner said Wednesday that military spending would rise beginning in 2018 and beyond.
Dans ce cadre, le président de la République a réaffirmé son engagement sur la montée progressive du budget des armées jusqu'à atteindre 2% du PIB en 2025.
He said the President of the Republic affirmed his commitment to a progressive increase in the armed forces budget to 2% of GDP by 2025. The United States is pressuring NATO allies to meet that 2% target as quickly as possible, but France's military is already committed on several fronts. Around 7,500 troops are deployed on the streets of French cities following recent terror attacks. French forces are engaged in military strikes against Islamic State jihadists in Syria and Iraq, and they are also taking the lead in counter-terror operations in North Africa. A 4,000-strong French force is deployed across the Sahel region. Again, Sophia Besch.
France's military activism of the recent decades, has led to the military being overstretched, to capabilities being underfunded.
Macron's pick for the new military chief, General François Lecointre, led the EU mission in Mali, which the president chose as his first state visit after taking office.
We can't tell yet what these cuts will mean for specific military missions, but we know that France under Macron will remain committed to French commitments in Africa.
Macron has called on European allies to share the burden of counter-terrorism operations in Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And here in the U.S., a Las Vegas parole board has granted parole for football, TV, and film star O.J. Simpson after 9 years in prison on armed robbery and kidnapping charges. The Hall of Fame athlete, who was acquitted at the conclusion of a sensational murder trial back in the 1990s, cited good behavior while imprisoned on the more recent convictions and told the court he wants to be released so that he can be with his family. VOA's Lori London asked Los Angeles criminal defense attorney Lisa Houlet, a former longtime L.A. County prosecutor, for her observation of the hearing.
I predicted a few weeks ago that ultimately his parole would be granted. I think the most notable thing about the process was how much Mr. Simpson talked, especially in response to some questions where perhaps he should have been a little less wordy. But ultimately, I think that the hearing officers already had their minds made up before today. And for the most part, this was more of a formality.
What went into the decision to grant him parole?
You know, they weigh a series of factors, and they come up with a score, and that score is supposed to reflect the risk assessment as to whether he should be paroled. And after weighing those various factors, his risk level was low. So by all accounts, he should have been paroled with that low risk assessment. And that's exactly why I predicted weeks ago that I thought it was headed this direction, because, you know, for the most part, Mr. Simpson has been a model inmate. He's been doing good things and trying to help others make good decisions, and he's done what he's supposed to do.
He did say some things about how, you know, he's never had any problems. He's a good guy. He's always been a good guy. That seemed a little interesting, given his history.
Yes, and that did stand out to me as I was listening, because I don't think that that is entirely accurate. You know, this is Mr. Simpson speaking, and he's giving an account of what he believes he has been in his life. And, you know, he hasn't had any significant convictions. I think there was an arrest for domestic violence during his marriage. But otherwise, he was not convicted of any serious crime. So in his mind, you know, he is a good guy.
I've heard some analysts talking about the fact that he really didn't seem remorseful for anything. Did you get that impression?
I did get that impression. And I think the most important part of an inmate at a parole hearing is to express contrition and remorse and to tell the board that you have learned from your mistakes and it won't happen again. That was glaringly absent. And again, I think that that was one of the problems that a lot of people noticed, was that in his wordiness, he was making excuses rather than expressing remorse. So, but, you know, it all ended up well for him. He still got paroled.
Right. So what is the American fascination with O.J. Simpson?
You know, I think it's the fame, and it's the you know, crash and burn of somebody that was so idolized and really on a pedestal for many, many years. You know, he grew up in a rough part of town, and he made a name for himself, and he was a notable athlete, and he won the Heisman, and he, you know, led his teams, you know, to victory. And then all of a sudden, all that came crashing down, and, you know, the star was no longer a star and was now, you know, a criminal defendant. So with that story, I think is still a public fascination about how that can happen and how someone's life can go so terribly wrong so quickly. And clearly, we're still fascinated with him, as evidenced today with, you know, the millions
right.
of people that were watching this parole hearing.
Everybody was gripped to the TV once again.
Once again.
Right. All the stations, yeah. All the networks were covering it.
From ESPN to all the major
right.
news networks, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so now, what's next?
Well, as I have said, you know, my advice to him would be to lay low and stay out of trouble. Whether or not that's possible for Mr. Simpson has yet to be seen. He's going to be a parolee, and when you are a parolee, you have terms and conditions that are set by the parole officer, and if you don't abide by those terms and conditions, you can go back to prison. And that's the same for Mr. Simpson. If he doesn't abide by those terms and conditions, he could find himself back in prison.
That is Los Angeles criminal defense attorney Lisa Houlet speaking with VOA's Lori London. It is time now to find out what's trending on social media, and here's International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, two never-ending stories, but don't worry, this report is only going to be a few minutes long. First, a viral video that showed up on Facebook this week. It's a Facebook Live video that appears to show a swirling storm cloud with thunder and wind sounds. It was viewed more than 17 million times by Facebook viewers as they marveled at this live look at the massive storm. But a lot of people quickly realized that this video wasn't actually a video at all. It was a short looping animation of a storm cell. Because that video continued on and on without end, people thought it was real, and quickly realized, however, that it wasn't, and angry comments ensued. Prompting a lot of questions, though. Where exactly did this video come from? Now, for that, we do have an answer. It was taken by a Slovenian photographer of a supercell in South Dakota back in June of 2015, and this short video that he put up on Instagram originally was looped over and over and over again to become this long Facebook Live. But the other big question that remains, why did this video get so popular? Especially because Facebook has announced that they're cracking down on what they call fake live videos, things that feature animated images or short looping videos like this one that try to pass themselves off as live, but actually aren't. But it's not just online videos that can go on forever, it's also your social media presence, which brings us to our next trending story today. University of Melbourne researchers say that social networks can actually use algorithms based on your previous activity and conversations to continue your social media activity even after you're dead. Kind of creepy stuff. Now, it's not clear how meaningful or comprehensible those conversations would be. We've seen artificial intelligence and algorithms try to do this in the past, replicating human conversations, and it doesn't always work out very well. But it's a very interesting step forward. As it stands now, though, there are services you can actually use to schedule emails or social posts to go out in the event of your death. There's one service where you can actually schedule posts to go out up to 999 years from now. Maybe a little bit ambitious there. It's kind of creepy and sci-fi, but there's a human element here. It speaks to people's desire to keep their memories alive even after they're gone. And in the digital age that we live in, that includes keeping the memories alive on social media.
How about that? 900 years. That's amazing. International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. Thank you, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says it plans to abstain from sending any commands to its two operating Mars rovers and its three orbiters currently circling the Red Planet from July 22nd to August 1st. The space agency says the temporary hiatus is because communication capability between Earth and Mars will be greatly reduced due to movements of the planets that will place the Sun directly between Earth and the Red Planet. According to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the break in communications is being made out of caution. Because of the expected degradation of the Earth-Mars signal, the space agency is concerned that any commands it would send to its orbiters and rovers during this time could become garbled during the roughly 55 million kilometer trip and put the missions at possible risk. However, NASA will continue to receive data from Mars during this time, and any information that would be disrupted will be retransmitted later. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Grammy-winning American rock band Imagine Dragons is wrapping up its European leg of a current tour, then heading to North America. VOA's David Byrd reports the group's third album, Evolve, has the band coming from a bit different place mentally and spiritually.
The members of Imagine Dragons say Evolve came out of a new mental attitude they found after taking a break from a grueling tour schedule. Group co-founder Dan Reynolds says that the break allowed him to refocus on the things and the people that matter most to him.
For myself, I was in a really just scattered, depressed headspace, and I think it just came from losing my sense of self almost to a degree, and all the abrupt changes. And I had dealt with depression when I was young, but it really took on a whole new level and was kind of a full year. So it was out of necessity. Long story short, it was out of necessity, more than even, I think, wanting or anything. It was just, we knew it was necessary to go home.
Guitarist Wayne Sermon says the touring, a seven-year stretch, took a toll, but things are better now.
I mean, the road can be a grind, you know. It feels a little bit like a traveling circus, and you know, you wake up and you're underground, You have no idea what city you're in. You think you have an idea of what region you're in, and you make your guess from there. But it can be a grind, but I think you do have to put yourself in the headspace.
The time off allowed Dan Reynolds to reconnect with his 4-year-old daughter, and he and his wife had twins. Reynolds says that when they were ready to work on Evolve, they hired Swedish producers Mattman and Robin, who have worked with Britney Spears, Tove Lo, and DNCE.
We started the record working with two Swedish producers, Mattman and Robin, and the reason we chose them, we tried a lot of different producers. The reason we chose them is they were both very opinionated, and they were both very minimalistic. Thunder, feel the thunder, lightning and the thunder, thunder. Feel the
thunder, lightning and the thunder, thunder, thunder. Dan Reynolds says Evolve is the first album that all members of the group have agreed is a good one and one they can be proud of. The band starts the North American leg of its current tour in Toronto, Canada, July 29th. Wayne Sermon says they are looking at touring with a fresh perspective.
For us, it's just a matter of sacrificing a certain amount of things in order for 2 hours of your life to be the ultimate high. Like, there's nothing better. Like, cliff jumping isn't as exciting to me as the idea of going on stage and playing for people that, you know, got a babysitter, fought traffic, you know, paid for the extra for parking, and, you know, showed up.
Imagine Dragons Evolve is in stores and available online now. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iranian authorities have reportedly sentenced another American citizen to a 10-year prison term on charges of espionage. A spokesman for Iran's judiciary, Gholam Hossein Mohseini Ejehi, made the announcement on July 16th. The Iranian judiciary's news site, Mizan, later identified the American as Shiwei Wang, a Princeton University graduate student who was born in Beijing. Princeton University said the student had been doing historical research for his doctoral dissertation about Iran's late Qajar dynasty and that he had been arrested months ago. The imprisonment and conviction of U.S. citizens and other foreign nationals falsely accused of crimes against national security have been an ongoing and dangerous trend in Iran. Despite hopes that the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, agreed to by Iran, the EU, and the P5+1 countries in 2015, would induce Iran to become a more responsible member of the international community, Iran has continued to engage in malign activity, including the arrest and imprisonment of U.S. citizens and other foreign nationals. In 2016, Iranian-American businessman Siamak Namazi was sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage. His 80-year-old Iranian-American father, Bakr, who had traveled to Iran to help his son after his arrest, was also sentenced to 10 years for the same crime. More victims of such unlawful behavior include Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, an Iranian-British national who worked for the charitable arm of Thomson Reuters and was sentenced to 5 years for purported security crimes, as well as free and open internet advocate Nizar Zaka, a Lebanese national and U.S. permanent resident, sentenced to prison for 10 years. These U.S. citizens and foreign nationals held by Iran vehemently protest their innocence. According to U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, detaining political prisoners is one of the worst human rights abuses a country can do. As she suggests, no country which engages in such behavior can have any credibility in the world. The United States calls on the Iranian government to release all individuals unjustly held in Iran, including U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, and allow them to reunite with their families.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.